Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Caroline Frazier, author of the new book Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers. Caroline Frazier grew up in the shadow of Ted Bundy, the most notorious serial murderer of women in American history. Surrounded by his hunting grounds and mountain body dumps and the brooding landscape of the Pacific Northwest. But in the 1970s and 80s, Bundy was just one perpetrator amid an uncanny explosion of serial rape and murder across the region. Why so many? Why so weirdly and nightmarishly gruesome? Why the senseless rise and then sudden fall of an epidemic of serial killing? Caroline Frazier is author previously of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder, which won the Pulitzer Prize, as well as the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Heartland Prize, and the Plutarch Award for Best Biography of the Year. She's also author of God's Perfect Child, Living and Dying in the Christian Science Church, and her writing has appeared in the New York Review of Books, New Yorker, The Atlantic, Los Angeles Times, and London Review of Books, among other publications. She lives in New Mexico and joins us today. Caroline Frazier, thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So I'm guessing you're getting this question a lot, but I have to ask it as well. So loved Prairie Fires, and I, you know, obviously expecting another book from you, and when it appeared, this was not what I expected, based on Prairie Fires. How did this one come about?
Yeah, I actually started this before I wrote Prairie Fires. There were parts of this I would have been thinking about for a long time, because I came from the Northwest and grew up there when a lot of these things were happening. So it's been in my mind for a long time. I think it is surprising to people when they've read Prairie Fires, but there are actually some rough similarities between Prairie Fires in this book and some of my other work as well, because I tend to look at American history and at some of the violence that's part of American history, and that was certainly the case with Prairie Fires.
So this book takes us back to the 1970s. In fact, you weave in some of your personal story. You grew up in Mercer Island, right? Pretty close to some of Ted Bundy's killings.
Yeah, I mean, Mercer Island is a well-known suburb of Seattle that's connected to it by the I-90 bridge, which was traveled frequently by Ted Bundy to get to and from his activities, I guess you could say. He abducted a couple of women in Seattle near where he lived and drove them across the bridge. I lived quite near that bridge. He also abducted women from Lake Sammamish, also quite close to where I lived. And so when I was growing up there, like many, many other, you know, girls and women, I was aware that all this stuff was happening, because I was about 13 in 1974 when he began his most notorious spate of murders.
In fact, you write, everybody knows somebody who almost went out with Ted Bundy.
Just something that was, people talked about it all the time in 1974, because of course nobody knew who he was at that point. And then when he was arrested in Utah in 1975, then people were, you know, it was just a huge media kind of pile on of who is this guy, who knew him, and people who knew him just couldn't even begin to believe that he had done these things.
You write about the 1970s. In fact, you hone in on one section on 1974. What do you talk about that? Of course, this is Nixon's presidency unraveling, other key points in that particular year.
Yeah, 1974 was a pretty bad year in many ways, I think, in the United States. It was 74, 75. It was a time when there were all kinds of of really bizarre and frightening crimes, bombings. There were many politically based bombings, abductions, Patty Hearst. There was just all kinds of stuff going on in the culture. There was, the Vietnam War was kind of in its final throes. Nixon was in trouble. The economy was in trouble. So there was a lot going on then. And I think that people were increasingly frightened by the state that the country was in.
You also had people hitchhiking, right? That's you predictably we've learned some people still hitchhike, but not in the numbers they used to. More unlocked doors and windows, I think,
Yeah,
back
that was
then.
certainly a part of the whole scene at that time. Girls, I mean, I had friends who hitchhiked. There were a lot of people on Mercer Island who hitchhiked from place to place, and that stopped with a big hurry around, the summer of 1974, because it became apparent that stuff like this was happening and that you just couldn't get into a stranger's car.
So 70s and 80s, serial killers, and crime up all across the US, but especially in Washington State, in the Seattle Tacoma area. But maybe lay out those statistics. It's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, there just is a kind of explosion of killers, which I don't think it was really understood at the time. The crime statistics certainly were up a great deal in the mid 70s. They had started climbing in the 60s, and by the mid 70s were really approaching levels that we hadn't seen before in this country. So people knew about violent crime. It took, I think, a long time to identify these individual killers and to see some kind of a pattern, that there was clearly a kind of association of some of these guys with Washington State. There was Bundy, there was the Green River Killer, who wasn't identified for many years. That turned out to be Gary Ridgway. There was the I-5 killer, who was driving up and down I-5 and abducting, raping, killing people in convenience stores, in their homes. The Hillside Strangler ended up in Washington State, bizarrely enough. So there's this long laundry list of killers between the, late 60s and the 80s, who are associated with this region. And people have just been asking for years, what could it have been? What was it about that time and that place?
Before we get into that, let me pause to ask how this was affecting you. You were a teenage girl at the time in what appeared to be the epicenter here. I don't know, that had to affect your sense of safety.
Yeah, I think it affected everyone's sense of safety. I think people were incredibly freaked out about it. And it wasn't just the sense of safety. There was also a weird, I think for me and for other young girls growing up at that time, we didn't know that this was not normal. I think part of what was odd about that whole period was that we kind of accepted it almost. I mean, there was a lot of hysteria about it in the media, but I think for me and for many other girls, it was kind of like, well, I guess this is just what happens, and you just have to kind of factor this in as a sort of, this is the way of life that we have here.
Some of these killers, we didn't know who they were for a long time, right? But take Ted Bundy, for example. Just a sociopath, right? Seemed to have no feeling Certainly no empathy. I mean, you quote him as saying he felt like he would never be caught because he said, I mean, there are so many people. Shouldn't be a problem. So, you know, I can kill a few. Not going to be missed, right? Gives you a little bit of glimpse into his mind and heart.
Yeah, he was very good at covering that up. He was very skilled at presenting a face to the world that mimicked a kind of somebody who was smart, somebody who was empathetic. One of his former girlfriends, you know, called him just the greatest guy and said that he was, you know, somebody who loved people, you know. So obviously she didn't really see that in him. And I think that didn't become apparent until much later after he'd been arrested. So he was, like a lot of these guys, he was a sociopath. He was somebody who did not recognize the rights of other people or the or right and wrong in any kind of way, but he was very, very good at hiding that. And I think to this day we still don't know how many people he may have killed.
Yeah, it's suspected, right? Before he got caught, there might have been many, many others. What about some of these other killers? And in fact, it's a weird and sick thing that a lot of these serial killers were very jealous of the reputations and kind of looked at each other, right? And were fans of each other.
Yeah. Ted Bundy became a kind of role model, bizarrely enough, to many of these guys who tried to either outdo him or to kind of come up to his level. They just saw his accomplishments, if you will, as something to be emulated. And I think a lot of these guys did consider what they were doing a kind of career, and looked to him as a model for that career.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll start to answer, at least your answer, to why this senseless rise and then sudden fall of this epidemic of serial killing, especially in the Pacific Northwest, although it was in many areas of the country. We're talking with Caroline Frazier. Her new book is called Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Caroline Frazier, author of the new book, Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers. Caroline Frazier grew up in the shadow of Ted Bundy in the Pacific Northwest. But in the 70s and 80s, Bundy was just one perpetrator amid an uncanny explosion of serial rape and murder across the region. And so Caroline Frazier asked the question, why so many? Why the senseless rise and the sudden fall of an epidemic of serial killing? So before we get into the reasons, talk to us about the fall. There was after the 70s and 80s, there was a pretty precipitous fall in this type of killing, right?
Yes, there was, and also in violent crime overall. You see the, as I was mentioning earlier, the rate of crime climbing in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and then reaching a kind of very high plateau, a rate of over 10, murders per 100,000 in this country, which we had not seen before. And then all of a sudden in the mid 90s, there's a very marked fall off in the crime rate in this country. And it was such a bizarre and really unprecedented fall in the rate of crime that sociologists and historians began looking at this and saying, why did this happen? How could this possibly have happened?
So what are some of the, before we get to the theory that you are talking about in your book, what are some of the theories that have been put out there?
Well, there was, of course, in the 90s, a real political reaction to the rise in the crime rate. So you had, Ronald Reagan and later Bill Clinton instituting new kinds of policies about policing and incarceration. Clinton, particularly, is noted for his new crime bill, which came along in the 90s, which is going to be associated with the whole three strikes and you're out thing. And you started seeing the incarceration rates go up quite sharply. And policing, a lot of resources are being funneled into police departments, and they begin various kinds of experiments in how to, increase the number of arrests and so forth. So you see a lot of changes in that. So that one theory really focuses on policing and the changes that were made to that. Then there was a shorter-lived theory about abortion. Because abortion had become legal, that fewer women were having unwanted children, or children who grew up in poverty. And so there was a theory that maybe abortion had something to do with the fall and the crime rate, although I believe that that was debunked. So those were a couple of the other theories.
Tell me about some of the theories as to why this explosion of serial killers, especially in the Northwest. I think one was these men were being born, post World War II, right? That maybe it was re-traumatized returning soldiers committing child abuse.
Yes, there was a theory about, and a lot of these theories kind of focus on the mother, this kind of blame the mother for the development of serial killers. I mean, this idea that all these guys went to World War II and were traumatized by their war experiences and came back and were maybe alcoholics or had various other mental problems, and that the women who were left alone to take care of the kids, maybe there was some factor in there. I mean, it's that theory to me has never really been very coherent in terms of what the evidence for it is, but that was one thing that people have talked about.
Now, acknowledging this is very complex, you've landed on the lead crime hypothesis. This is not original with you, right? This has been acknowledged. Tell me about this.
Yeah, well, after the fall off in the crime rate in the 90s, this was one thing that people were looking at was the fact that in the earlier decades of the 1900s, beginning in the 1920s, leaded gas came on the market. And wasn't really, I think, a huge deal until about World War II. But of course, after the war, during the war, after the war, we as a culture in the United States began driving much more. There was lots of commuting, lots of driving. People owned more cars. And so the rate of leaded gas, the use of it, went up quite a bit. And so in this country, we were essentially conducting a kind of experiment on ourselves. And medical scientists, beginning in the 1920s, had said this is a very bad product. This is not something that should be used because lead is a poison. Lead is a toxin, and it has a whole host of effects in the human body, including quite marked neurological effects, especially on the growing brain. So, kids who are exposed to lead may have deficits in their development, their neurological development. And that led inevitably, and this has been shown very strongly, I think, in scientific studies, to a rise in the crime rate, because many kids who had lead exposure then went on to become juvenile delinquents in their teen years, or to become people who committed violent crimes. So that's been shown pretty prevalently. And one of the causes for that lead exposure was leaded gas. Another cause that tended to compound what everybody was getting from leaded gas was lead from smelters. Smelters used to be very, very common in this country. They're not now, but for a period between the, you know, mid-1800s to about the 1980s, many cities had smelters, and there were a lot of smelters in the American West, in places like Tacoma, Washington, where Ted Bundy and Gary Ridgway grew up, and in Utah. Utah had quite a lot of smelters because they had a lot of mining, and smelters were essentially processing ores from the mines. You also had a famous smelter in El Paso, Texas, which is where Richard Ramirez, the infamous Night Stalker, grew up. So when I was looking at the lead crime hypothesis, I kind of expanded it as part of my story to include serial killers, but it already existed in terms of being one of the explanations for the rise of violent crime.
It seems like the lead in the brains of these developing men, I guess that's where I want to go, that it's men, right? Something about males, that the lead in the developing brain tends to affect them more than females?
Yes. It has turned out that, lead isn't good for anybody. What seems to have happened is that in women, for example, you see higher rates of impulsivity, and they have done studies on the rise of teen pregnancy, for example, which really went up quite sharply also in the 70s and 80s. But in men, it seems to have a worse effect because it really does prevent the frontal cortex from developing properly. And so you see gaps in the scans, the MRI scans of males who have been exposed to lead. And those gaps are in places where, you know, these are parts of the brain that control impulse, impulsivity, they control aggression. And so in males, you see a higher rate of acting out, of aggression, of delinquency, of violent crime.
Do we, lead is bad, right? Across the board, would it affect some people more than others? What I'm getting to there, you know, that not everybody became a serial killer, for example.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, the results of this stuff is so difficult to determine because in some studies have shown that, and it really depends on the amount of lead, but some kids who are exposed to lead have real developmental difficulties associated with learning. You know, they have a very difficult time in school. They have, they're considered to be slow learners. Others are quite smart. I mean, you look at Ted Bundy, he was a very intelligent guy who went to college and he was getting a law degree when he got caught. And so there's a huge spectrum of this. And I think, it's not just how much lead you might have been exposed to, it's a whole lot of other factors too, including your home environment, abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse. People are looking now at head trauma quite closely as well. I mean, you see this in the football injuries and so forth, that head trauma on top of some of these other things can cause heightened aggression. So I think there are a whole host of factors that go into this, and we're only just now kind of beginning to learn about it.
On Access Utah today, we're talking with Caroline Frazier, previously author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. She's also written God's Perfect Child, Living and Dying in the Christian Science Church. Her new book, out now, is called Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers. So I want to get into these smelters. Particularly the smelter in Tacoma. Unusually, this one was right downtown, I think, right? Give us an idea of how much lead this was pumping out.
Yeah, this was one of these really unfortunate things that the smelter was originally built on the shore of Commencement Bay in Tacoma in the late 1880s, early 1890s, before the city had really grown very much. And so I think they had no idea of what they were doing in terms of the placement of it. And gradually the city grew up around it. And the smelter, which began as a lead smelter and then later focused largely on copper, was doing what smelters do, which is burning ores. And when you burn ores, a lot of particulates are created that go up a smokestack. And this smelter had a huge smokestack that was putting out hundreds of tons by the 1960s and 70s, hundreds of tons of lead particulates, which is a waste product of copper smelting, and arsenic. And so you had this incredibly toxic stuff coming out of the smokestack that was supposed to be diffused by the height of the stack. It was supposed to just sort of blow away in the wind. But of course, that's not really what happened. And the smelter, as people began realizing in the 60s and 70s, was polluting about 1,000 square miles of the Puget Sound area.
Affecting everybody, right? It's at incredibly high levels.
Yeah, I mean it's really extraordinary what they did and continued to do, even though they knew it was quite dangerous for the population.
There was a plant, you write about the plant smelter in Idaho, I think it was, where at one point an executive there had to make a decision. Knowing that it's going to harm the populace, he made a cost life, cost health analysis, and decided just to keep on smelting, I guess.
Yeah, this is a really horrifying story that came out of the mine called Bunker Hill. Everybody called it Uncle Bunker because it was the chief employer in that town of Kellogg, Idaho. And this is a mountain town that's in a valley, Box Canyon. And in 1973, they had a fire at the smelter that destroyed much of their filtration system. These plants didn't have great filtration to begin with, but this was the only thing that was keeping the amount of lead somewhat under control. This was a lead smelter. The smelter was right across the street from an elementary school. And after this fire, they had to make a decision, the company, whether they were going to continue operating or sacrifice their profits. And in 1973, 1974, the profits were quite high. So they were loath to shut down the plant to rebuild the filtration system. And so they just decided to go ahead with it. And the guy who was running the plant in Idaho did this kind of back of the napkin calculation that even if they ended up having to pay $11 or $12 million per child who was poisoned by lead, they could still make a very tidy profit. And so, I mean, it's really astonishing, the kind of moral, the gap in the kind of moral calculation of these people that they just, and in many ways, I think are not dissimilar from somebody like Ted Bundy. They're not seeing the effects they're having on other people, and they don't care about the effects. They just decide to go ahead and do it anyway.
This plant in Tacoma was owned by the Guggenheim family, right? And
Yes.
this is not a totally unusual theme in American history. Incredible fortunes being made on the backs of the lives and health of people.
Yep. Behind every great fortune is a great crime, is what they say. And this was certainly true with ASARCO, which was the American Smelting and Refining Company, which ended up being, it originated with the Rockefellers and ended up being owned by the Guggenheims. But yes, I mean, it's an old story, tragically, in American history that capitalism is privileged over virtually any other value. And so you see ASARCO all over the American West, building these smelters, acquiring smelters, and doing everything to cover up the effects of what they're doing. There was an ASARCO smelter in Murray, Utah, for many, many years, which there was a whole movement to shut the Murray smelter down. I think it was the largest lead smelter in Utah. And the farmers eventually, I think, organized and were able to shut that down by 1950. But I think it took them a very, very long time to clean up that whole area.
I guess a parallel today would be the Sackler family, right?
Sure.
The opioid crisis, you build a big fortune, and then you try to minimize it or run away from it or gild it over. What about your thoughts are? If you were to visit the Guggenheim Museum today, what surely for you and people who may read the book, that would be colored.
Yeah, I
By
mean
this, wouldn't it?
it's extraordinary. I mean we saw in real time the Sacklers doing this, buying art and art collect creating these massive art collections and opening museums with the Sackler name on them, becoming a great power in that world. But the Guggenheims were there before. I mean, the Guggenheims essentially, whitewashed their activities by exactly the same process. Peggy Guggenheim was a very famous art collector, and her collection became the core of the collection at the Guggenheim Museum. And I think now, if you asked, people walking down the streets of New York City where the Guggenheim money came from, I bet very, very few people could tell you the answer to that question, which just shows you how successful they were in covering up.
Let's take a break. We'll come back with the last segment with Caroline Frazier. We're talking about her new book. It's out and available now. It's called Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Caroline Fraser, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner for Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. The new book out and available now is called Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers. Caroline Fraser, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about yourself in this. You know, that's one of the threads you sew into this narrative, I guess. 13 years old when Ted Bundy's murders kind of hit the press. You lived in that exact area, but you were going kind of through your own domestic drama there.
Yeah, I really wanted to kind of return to the 1970s, if you will, and give people a sense of what a different time it was. And it's not so much that we've made huge progress in a lot of these issues like domestic violence and so forth, but it was a very different time for women in the 1970s. It was, you know, the 60s had brought this kind of explosion of interest in women's rights, but a lot of that stuff was very it was just kind of getting started in terms of the debate about issues around violence and women, around rape, changes to rape laws, changes to laws that affected women in the workplace regarding harassment and not just harassment, but just, you know, trying to get ahead in the workplace for women. So it was a really different time. I wanted to give people a sense of how women were treated really differently. It wasn't, you know, the Mad Men era of the 1950s. We'd made some progress, but not a lot. And I think that I wanted to show, by way of talking a little bit about my family and my high school and so forth, what it was like to grow up in that time. And it was a time of, as I mentioned, of real violence and instability in the culture at large.
And a fascinating story about your father as well. You know, people could check out, I guess, the God's Perfect Child for more on that, but you do write a little bit more about it, that in this book. What if we talk a little bit more about these serial killers? I was reading an interview you gave, and that the interviewer asked about how do you write about these killers without buying into glamorizing them, and undoubtedly the media did glamorize some of these killers. You called them sad, pathetic losers. And that it's important that we see that truth. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I felt that when I was writing this, that it was important to describe what they were doing in a really factual and kind of honest manner, if you will. I think that a lot of the, especially the Hollywood versions of somebody like Ted Bundy, glamorize him just almost by accident because they can't bring themselves to, you know, to do it any other way because it's Hollywood, you know. So they cast somebody who's a very good-looking guy and focus almost entirely on his personality. But I think I wanted to focus on what he actually did and what these other guys did, because it is so horrifying when you read a description of their attacks on women out of the clear blue sky. I mean, a lot of these people had no connection to the person that killed them. And so I wanted people to get a sense of who these guys were and what they did and how similar these crimes are in a lot of ways, that there's nothing remotely glamorous about any of them, and that the brutality and almost bestiality, I think, of a lot of what they did is something we should not forget, because I think that casts some light on what might have caused these crimes to begin with.
We're living now in a violent time, right? It's more political violence. Any lessons we can learn from the 1970s to today?
I think one thing people should realize is that even with the incredibly horrifying and distressing series of school shootings, mass shootings, etc., that those things, horrifying though they are, should not blind us to the fact that violent crime is down strikingly in this country at this moment, and that it has been declining for many, many years. And so I think that there is way too much emphasis in certain parts of the press on hyping up these, I mean, there is no way to hype up the statistics. So they basically just make extraordinary claims that this is a terribly violent time. It actually isn't. And I think people need to understand that. If you go and look at the FBI statistics, we're generally speaking at a much lower crime rate, violent crime rate, than we have been. It did go up briefly during COVID, but it never reached the levels that it did, for example, in the 1970s and 80s. So people, while this does not wipe out concerns that people have about it, people should realize that we actually are living in a safer country.
I want to talk about regulation. There is concern about, in some people's views, going the wrong way with, relaxing regulations on the environment. Smelters probably not going to come back in the U.S., right? But they do exist in other countries.
That's true. I mean, we basically offshored a lot of the smelting business to places in South America, China, Russia, etc. So there's still a lot of these heavy metals entering the environment in those places. But we do still have problems here because, as with the Murray smelter that I was mentioning earlier, sometimes these places don't get cleaned up. They can have very serious lead depositions that were, lead was falling there in particulate form for decades. And so there are various hot spots in a lot of United States cities where there were smelters that were not cleaned up. And we still have what are called secondary smelters, which are recycling places where, you take your car batteries, for example, which are full of lead. There we have lots of things that have to be recycled, and those secondary smelters themselves are sources of pollution in major cities. So I think we can't ever forget that a lot of the stuff that we use and rely on contains these toxic elements, and we have to figure out ways to track where they're being left.
A couple, 2 or 3 minutes left. So I want to have you talk about the Seattle Bridge, this floating bridge that was there between Seattle and Mercer Island. That becomes kind of another character in the book. Not connected to the smelter, but I don't know what lesson to take away from this. Well-intentioned blunders. I don't know. Tell me about this bridge.
Yeah, the Mercer Island floating bridge, when it was built in 1940, was considered, almost one of the wonders of the world because it's this bridge that's floating on the surface of Lake Washington and connecting via I-90, Boston all the way to Seattle. It's the last leg of the I-90 interstate. So it was hailed as this technological triumph. But like the smelters, I think it is an example of kind of engineering hubris, that people thought, oh, there can't be anything wrong with the kind of progress that's represented by the floating bridge. But in fact, as somebody who had to drive across it for many, many years, and thousands of other people saw this as well, the bridge was really dangerous. It was engineered badly because it included what was called a bulge, which directed traffic in this kind of curve around a mechanism that opened the bridge for ship traffic. They also instituted a reversible lane, which is something that, has been a factor in like the Golden Gate Bridge, I think, has had a reversible lane. But it was so dangerous on this bridge because the bridge was so narrow. It was just built way too small for the amount of traffic that then eventually used it. And there were all kinds of head-on collisions and horrifying things where people just went flying off the bridge in their cars and had to be fished out later from the bottom of the lake. So it was a kind of a terrifying example of engineering gone wrong at a time when engineers, I think, were seen as sort of these godlike figures who could do anything. I mean, Boeing was in Seattle, for example, and everybody really respected Boeing engineers, understandably. But I think these things can have a real dark side and a real cost to society, same as with smelters. And so I did want it to become a kind of character in the book that makes people question, what was the cost of all this progress?
By the way, what's there now? They build a regular
Well, the
bridge, or what?
original floating bridge sank because too much water was allowed to get into it when they were trying to repair that bridge. But there are now two newer bridges in the same place. It's much, much safer. It was much better engineered, although I will point out that they are building a light rail across one of those bridges, which I hope is fabulous, but we're talking about an area where earthquakes, very, very powerful earthquakes, are not unknown. And so you kind of worry about the infrastructure in the Pacific Northwest for that very reason.
Well, we'll leave it there at the end of our hour. We've been talking with Caroline Frazier, author. Most recently, the new book is Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killer. Caroline Frazier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.